This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. What's the word? Not guilty to aiding the enemy. That's the most important verdict today for leaker Private Bradley Manning. We want your opinion on the verdict. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. We'll be referring to those opinions, taking your contributions all hour long. Lots more about the verdict in just a moment. Plenty to talk about this hour, including President Obama's role in the latest Middle East peace talks between Israelis and Palestinians. Later this hour, we'll note the president's visit to an Amazon warehouse and shipping facility in Chattanooga, Tennessee, where Amazon has announced it is hiring thousands of new workers, including 2,000 customer service representatives. We want to hear your customer service stories this hour. We'll share some and talk about how critical customer service is in the post-2008 U.S. economy. But first, 3 years is enough. That's what a placard outside the courtroom in Fort Meade, Maryland, where Private Bradley Manning heard his verdict. That's what the placard said. He's been in military custody since 2010. He learned his fate today, not the sentence, but certainly the verdict. Military Judge Colonel Denise Lind opened with a bombshell in the courtroom in Fort Meade, Maryland, declaring Manning not guilty on the government's most serious charge of aiding the enemy, a charge that carried a life sentence. It was central to the government's aggressive case against Manning. He was found guilty of leaking classified documents and violating the Espionage Act, charges that he had already confessed to. The sentencing phase of this trial begins tomorrow, according to the judge. It's been more than 3 years since he was arrested, more than 3 years since he uploaded more than 700,000 classified documents, more than 3 years since he made WikiLeaks a global phenomenon and changed the world's understanding of the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and changed our nation's relationship with the rest of the world in some sense. Joining us now to talk about what is at stake in this very important verdict, in this landmark trial of Private Bradley Manning, is Karen Greenberg, Director of the Center on National Security at Fordham University's School of Law. Karen, welcome.
Hi, John.
So what did Judge Lind say about the government's case to prosecute him for this charge of aiding the enemy?
So I think that is going to be the subject of debate going forward, how the judge made the distinction between the aiding the enemy charges and the rest of the charges. And it's something that will play out in public discourse as time goes along. But basically, she was not convinced that he did this in a way that he knew he was aiding the enemy. And the question underlying all of this may be, what exactly was the harm that occurred with what he did? The government doesn't seem to have proved that there was harm. They theoretically could have been harm. But just what he did and what harm it caused was not proven at the trial. And I think that very much may have gone to why the judge was willing to make distinctions that I think surprised people on all sides of the trial.
So this is, aside from all of the kind of pointy-headed notions that we all had in talking about this case, that it would be a redefinition of government secrecy and that it might take a look at what classified documents are all about, this seems like a fairly straightforward criminal case where the government didn't prove malicious intent, didn't prove the basics of the case like harm, and the question of government secrecy and the wider implications of the Bradley Manning case, that's for another day.
I think that's essentially correct. I think the bottom line here is that in leaking classified documents, Bradley Manning violated the law and that there has to be some accounting for that. But whether or not it rises to the highest level of a national security crime does not seem to have been persuasive or proven. On the issue of just what can be put out in the public domain and by whom, I think on that point, you may be right. We still don't know where that line is. But what you are learning is that the context in which this decision came down, this verdict came down, may have everything to do with the other issues that are going on right now in terms of who can say what, who can leak what, and what kind of consequences there will be through the legal system.
Well, let's talk. Let's not reconvene law school here to a certain extent, but give us a sense of the importance of Manning and his attorney's decision to be confined to a judge's decision here, to not opt for a jury trial here. How important do you think that was?
tremendously important. I think in national security cases writ large, particularly, let's say, in terrorism cases, you're often sitting there thinking, I wonder what would have happened if this had been a bench trial, if it had been decided without a jury and only by the judge. And the reason is that in order to understand national security cases, you really do have to have a breadth of understanding of something beyond what the judge seems to be able to charge juries with. And you've seen more, you understand more, you're read into more policy considerations, and I think it had a tremendous impact. And I'm sure that the defense team is now thinking that it was a very wise decision.
Hmm. And back on the questions of procedure in a military courtroom, now if Manning had confessed to crimes in the civilian court system, it would have been a plea deal. There wouldn't have been a trial, in this case, a court-martial. How come the prosecution was able to compel a trial even though Bradley Manning confessed?
Because there were a number of charges. He confessed to some of them, and he didn't confess to others of them, and so they were going to try him on that. I don't see that as the biggest distinction, you know, in terms of not having a plea ahead of time. But you're raising a very interesting question, which is now we see a national security trial within the context of a court-martial. This is not a military commissions at Guantanamo Bay. This is not a federal Article III court prosecution of a terrorism suspect in the United States. We've now seen a court Marshall. And you know what? As you said, it worked out in a way that was able to have some nuance, some legitimacy, and to understand how national security prosecutions need to be done in a very thoughtful way that is not either black or white, but there is some gray area. And they were able to handle that in a way many of these other prosecutions have not been able to do.
Is this a question of the prosecution overcharging here and that the judge is really saying that you really pushed it too far?
That is an excellent question. And I think it goes right to the heart. And the answer is probably yes, that they did overcharge, that they what happens in the context of national security prosecutions, as we've seen since 9/11, is that they are slam dunks. If you are accused of a national security crime, it is considered that you are practically guilty before you're tried. And so you may as well go for the largest charge. And there's been a move towards going for higher and higher charges on these kinds of crimes since maybe the middle of the Bush administration. And yes, it's a real wake-up call to think twice about how you're going to charge these crimes, because guess what? Don't overreach, because here's the bottom line. This guy is guilty. And he is going to be sentenced with some form of sentencing. And there will be an acknowledgement that that's a crime, and that's enough. What happens now is that the headlines will say acquitted. They will have the word acquitted in it. He's not acquitted any more than Mr. Gailani, who was the Guantanamo detainee, was acquitted. But it doesn't look good for the prosecution to put themselves in that situation.
We're talking with Karen Greenberg, director of the Center on National Security at Fordham University's School of Law, on the verdict in the Bradley Manning case. Hold on, Karen, for just a moment. Ed Pilkington joins us, reporter for The Guardian in Fort Meade, Maryland. Ed, welcome.
Hi.
What was it like in that courtroom?
Well, like a huge sense of expectation, both inside the court, but also outside where the hundreds of protesters are gathered, Manning supporters. And the judge, Colonel Denise Lynch, she doesn't make it easy for us. She barked out her verdict. It began with this aiding the enemy charge and finding not guilty, which is a very important, significant ruling. But then she immediately went into the opposite by doing a string of guilty, 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 guilty. It just went on and on. She found him guilty of virtually all the charges that he was accused of, bar that one important aiding the enemy charge.
Reaction among protesters, reaction among people in the courtroom, reaction from Bradley Manning?
Well, the dust is settling here, and you get this feeling that the huge dust cloud has been created, and it's going to take a while to sort of work our way through this. I think the overriding message that's coming through already is that he has been found guilty of a huge number of charges, at least 17 counts in their entirety, and four more in slightly amended form. And by my initial count, which, you know, it may change, but my initial count is that if he was given the maximum sentence, he could face 130 years in jail, which is, by all intents and purposes, a life sentence. So this is very, very serious. It's the seventh prosecution under the Espionage Act under the Obama administration, and it's really the first in which a very, very major prison sentence will follow.
Ed Pilkington, reporter for The Guardian in Fort Meade, Maryland, where that verdict was handed down. Karen Greenberg, does this verdict have more implications for the Snowden case or for what's going on in Guantanamo before we go?
I don't know about Guantanamo, but it will definitely play out in the Snowden case and in the attempts for the Assange case to indict and bring Assange to some sort of justice or trial in the United States. So in both ways, I think it will be a sign that these are not going to be such easy cases. And we don't know the future of how the American public, the judiciary, and other people both in power and in the citizenry think about these leak prosecutions. So we're at the beginning of the story, and that's what it tells us.
And we're certainly going to find out more in the next weeks and months. Karen Greenberg, director of the Center on National Security at Fordham University's School of Law, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, assessing the importance of the latest Israeli-Palestinian peace talks in Washington. But before we take a break, we want to note this fact that the United Nations reported earlier this year. The world today is facing its greatest refugee crisis in more than two decades. 45 million people forcibly displaced from their homes. What does that mean? Well, in a sense, it means 45 million different things. I remember back in the late 1980s, during the worst days of the civil war in Lebanon. There was no access to the fighting in Beirut, but in southern Lebanon, we in the press corps could see it in the faces of the refugee families fleeing south toward Israel. Somewhere they would never otherwise go, but for the fact that they feared for their lives. I remember, it may sound strange, I remember this chicken. A little boy was carrying it with his mom and brother. They had walked for days. My sense of the people of Lebanon was that they didn't keep chickens for pets, and so I asked the little boy why he was carrying his chicken. He looked at me and said, through tears, that his chicken would lay eggs, so his mother would never have to go out in the bombs again, he said, to find food. The whole war in Lebanon summed up in the face and the voice of one child, one refugee. Over the next few days, we will be presenting refugee stories from around the world told in the voices of the refugees themselves. Listen for them, add to them, a community of global citizens in refugee nation on the move, escaping conflict from Syria to Africa to East Asia and in this hemisphere as well. We always want to hear from you. Give us a call, 877-8MYTAKE, or find us at facebook.com/thetakeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
So after weeks of shuttle diplomacy, this week Secretary of State John Kerry has brought Israeli and Palestinian leaders together for the first peace talks in over 3 years.
Many difficult choices lie ahead for the negotiators and for the leaders as we seek reasonable compromises on tough, complicated, emotional, and symbolic issues.
A lot of questions about what's going to happen from these talks. This is a great moment to speak with Ambassador Dennis Ross, former Middle East peace negotiator under Presidents George H.W. Bush and President Clinton. He's currently counselor at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Ambassador Ross, welcome to The Takeaway.
Nice to be with you. Thank you.
Do you think there's a real opportunity here? It's my sense that nothing can really be done while Egypt and Syria and so much of the Middle East is in turmoil right now. This looks like an attempt to get some sort of a deal under the radar with so much going on in the Middle East. What's your assessment?
Well, I think you just put your finger on something, which is seemingly paradoxical. On the one hand, in the midst of all this turmoil, that would seem to create a kind of chilling effect for doing anything. On the other hand, it's precisely this notion of under the radar. everybody in the region is completely preoccupied with everything else except the Israeli-Palestinian issue. And precisely because of that, that actually creates some political space for Israelis and Palestinians alike to do something, number one, without necessarily the same kind of fear of a backlash from the traditional quarters you would expect of the rejectionists. And at the same time, that very turmoil also gives them some incentive to think about maybe we should try to work something out before that turmoil comes here.
How much are these talks, do you think, an attempt to redeem John Kerry's longstanding relationship with the principals here, his sense of credibility and goodwill among all the parties here in the first really major initiative of his tenure as Secretary of State?
Well, I think it does have a lot to do with it, because he has developed a relationship with both leaders over a very long period of time. In the case of Prime Minister Netanyahu, he actually knows him going back to the time when Prime Minister Netanyahu was in Boston. So it's a very long historical relationship. In the case of Abu Mazen, he's cultivated a relationship from the time that he was in the Senate for a very long period of time. The value of having those personal relationships is in many ways hard to quantify. I mean, one of the things I can tell you is, as someone who negotiated for a long time in this area, there's no substitute for personal relationships. By itself, it's not enough. But without it, you're unlikely to overcome some of the hurdles that you're going to have to overcome. Bear in mind, this is a historic conflict where leaders have to take on history and mythology. And it means there's a very strong psychological, emotional element to any negotiations. And the relationship that a Secretary of State has with leaders therefore becomes really an important asset, and I think in this particular case, Secretary Kerry has that.
More important than President Obama's relationship with the principals here?
Well, again, you know, it may seem counterintuitive, but if you look at the history of peacemaking in this part of the world, secretaries of state have often been the pivotal figures. Secretary Kissinger was, President Nixon, President Ford were not. In the case of President Carter, obviously, it was a different story. But if you take a look at during the first Bush administration, it was Jim Baker. It wasn't President Bush. It was Jim Baker who forged the Madrid Conference and basically ended an era of basically politics or diplomacy through denial. So I would say a lot depends upon the role that a Secretary of State can play. And while the president is important and may be critical at certain moments, the fact of the matter is, if a Secretary of State has this kind of relationship, it may well be something that is essential.
I tend to be rather theatrical, as you well know, on some of these things. I suspect the negotiators are sitting down. I have this vision of them looking at a bunch of old coffee-stained folders, looking at all of the initiatives going back over the last 15, 20 years that have attempted to forge some sort of pathway to the really tough issues. What are they looking at in terms of a process, or are we going to start anew here and do something called the Washington Initiative?
Well, I do think it's can't be a case that you're just reinventing the wheel. I mean, this has been a wheel that's turned many times before, as you indicate. But I do think what's going on here is a chance to start anew. And in effect, I think what they're probably doing is sort of two things. First, they've got to figure out, all right, what's the rhythm of our negotiations going to be? What are the modalities of the negotiations going to be? How often should we meet? How does the U.S. fit into it? Where should we meet? Presumably, it's going to be in the area because that's where they live. And you want to have negotiators who are close to the leaders. One of the reasons the negotiations really always have to take place out there is because that's where the leaders are. And the negotiators can't stray too far from where the leaders are because they get their guidance from them. They're basically told what they can do and what they can't do. They need to check with the leaders. So I suspect what you see is part procedure right now and part an agenda-setting approach. And then they have to figure out conceptually, all right, what are the issues that we want to deal with first? They'll know what are the full array of issues, but maybe what they'll try to do a little differently is maybe they'll try to come at some of these issues a little differently and see if they can pick out one or two and begin a process where they look for ways to make some early progress. I mean, one key point that I've constantly made, we're dealing in a context of disbelief with the two publics. The Israeli public doesn't believe that the Palestinians are serious about pursuing a two-state outcome, and the Palestinian public doesn't believe the Israelis are serious about pursuing a two-state outcome. They need to see that something's different this time. This is the 20th year of Oslo, so they need to see that something's different this time. And I think that means not only tackling certain issues maybe a little differently, but maybe it also means what can you do at the same time to show life's going to change on the ground as a way of getting both publics to take a second look at the whole process.
Peace process under the radar, looking for signals of substantive talks. Ambassador Dennis Ross, former Middle East peace negotiator under Presidents George H.W. Bush and Clinton, currently counselor at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
The famous Mason-Dixon line from the 1760s, separating the free states from the slave states, starts on the western border of Maryland and Pennsylvania and heads straight eastward until it meanders into the swampy flatlands of the eastern shore of Maryland. The eastern shore, this peninsula of craggy, steamy farmland, is like nowhere else in America. And there, right where there was supposed to be a clear line between slavery and freedom, archaeologists have unearthed evidence of a community of freed slaves and free blacks in the eastern shore town of Easton, the historically black neighborhood known as The Hill. It appears to be the oldest independent community of free blacks in the U.S., defying conventional wisdom as well as the barbaric map-making of Mr. Mason and Mr. Dixon. Dr. Mark Leone is a professor of anthropology at the University of Maryland who's been heading the dig of The Hill in the backyard of a building that dates back to the 1790s.
What we've discovered is, we believe, the remains of three free people of African descent who were listed in the 1800 federal census as being on the property. We had hoped to find a house or a building associated with them, but what we found, we believe, is evidence that at least one of them was a smith. So there's a lot of slag, nails, what are called nail forms, or the raw material from which nails were made when it comes from the foundry.
What was it about the Eastern Shore and Easton, Maryland particularly, that was apparently very welcoming to freed African-American slaves, to Africans, whatever the circumstances?
Quakers and Methodists both were abolitionists later in their histories. But certainly by the time slavery was at its height on the Eastern Shore, but in the small town of Easton, people who bought their freedom or were given their freedom set up a town, and there were between 400 and 500, and they are the people who bought the idea or were given the idea in the American Revolution that they should enjoy complete liberty like people of European descent. And I personally believe, as a scholar and an archaeologist, that it is this community that actually produces the energy and community spirit behind both Harriet Tubman, who's local, and Frederick Douglass, who was born within walking distance of the Hill.
How did these people live? In a sense of secrecy? Were they openly advocates of the abolitionist movement?
The image of the of Talbot County and Maryland's Eastern Shore, and indeed of this whole part of the Upper South, is of slavery, segregation, racism. But I think there's another history that begins with the Revolution, and may indeed be earlier, but we can recover some of it archaeologically by the time of the Revolution and throughout the 19th century, and that is many communities of self-sustaining African Americans protected by working with, in collaboration with surrounding European communities, people of European descent, white folks, in other words. Freedom meant something to black people and to white people, and they both understood that they couldn't have the fullest measure of freedom without understanding, acknowledging, and helping each other.
Descendants from that original community still alive today on the Hill?
Many, 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 many. We have wonderful censuses that begin in 1760, kept by the Lloyd family, who owned many slaves at nearby White House, which, as I said, is associated with Douglas, and the surnames there. And these are censuses with first names and last names of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of enslaved Africans that the Lloyds owned. And their great-great-grandchildren are the people who are sponsoring this excavation and whose remains are in it.
Dr. Mark Leone, professor of anthropology at the University of Maryland, thanks so much.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Our refugee story today comes from Jordan, which is the front line of the humanitarian crisis in Syria. There are some 500,000 Syrian refugees, and more than 54% are children under the age of 18, according to the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. From the refugee nation, 45 million strong all around the world, we have two voices today, both from one of the world's largest refugee camps, the Za'atari camp in Jordan. Emma Bonar gets to hear these stories every day. She's the Norwegian Refugee Council Project Coordinator for the Youth Center at the Za'atari camp.
The impact is clear. You have a huge number coming over living in a camp setting. The stability that they had back home in Syria has turned into some kind of chaos. There are protection issues, of course. There are a lot of young girls in the camp. A lot of the refugees, maybe 55, 60% of them are under 18. So things have changed a lot. Their lives have changed.
And I'm going to play some audio from one of the young girls that you're speaking of here, who describes some of the circumstances of leaving Syria and also gives you a sense of just how being a refugee is the last thing most of the people in Syria ever thought they would be. Listen.
When we were in Syria, some people from our town who were here in Jordan used to telephone us saying, "Do not come." I mean, there are things in the camp that are not good, like carrying water, like the dust, the weather. Some people said, "Yes, come over. It is better than the shelling, better than the bombardment, better than the arrests, better than seeing our children being slain around us."
That's Imtinan. She's a young girl in our youth program in Za'atari camp. She participates in a variety of activities like civic engagement programs, like art activities. By coming to our program every day, she's built up a network of a little community. She has colleagues who come with her. She's built up a relationship with the teachers in our center. So some form of stability has returned to her life because of that.
And you can hear in the voices of some of these people how much that work is really something they are clinging to journey back to some sense of normalcy. Here's one of the teachers at your center. Listen.
My work starts at 8:30 a.m. I meet with the students. We have approximately 14 students. We understand very well that the place in which we are staying is not as important as the fact that we are together, and we must be active in the society because our society is passing through its most difficult situations. It is passing through the most difficult moments in which it needs us. So we do not stand by, as they say, with hands folded. We must work and work and work.
So that was Ali, one of our teachers for the civic engagement program. Ali's a really great example of someone within the community who's really trying to improve things for all those around him. He's got a lot of great leadership qualities. The youth really look up to him. But you can hear from what he says, you can see that all of the people in the camp want a sense of purpose. They want to belong to something. They want to rebuild structures around themselves. And they also realize that the children and the youth are the future of Syria. These are the people who will go back and rebuild the country one day. So the community needs to support them.
Ali has a real palpable sense of hope about the future. I want to play you one last comment from Ali, the teacher at your center, and then we'll talk about it.
My ambition is that one day I will have offered something and not stood idly by. In my opinion, every person has a role to play. A person can shift from one position to another, but the most important thing is not to stand idly by. I just wanted to have a role.
So, Emma, I'm wondering if a clock is ticking there. If the situation in Syria goes on too long, do these refugees lose that sense of engagement, lose that sense of being part of some new Syria, and fade into a kind of netherworld like so many refugees have in the past?
I think what we hear from what Ali has said is that he's holding on to that hope for the future. And he's not only holding on to it, but he's trying to do something about it and improve it in the situation he's in now, despite it being difficult. So by giving the youth, again, some sense of routine and normalcy in their lives, but also restoring some hope for their future, he's really contributing to that.
Emma Bonar is Education Coordinator for the Norwegian Refugee Council in Jordan. Emma, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
The story of the last 100 years in physics is the story of our radically changed understanding of the nature of space and time and the structure of matter. The story of the next 100 years is looking to be the ways in which humans take practical advantage of some of the strangest features of the theories of relativity and quantum mechanics. Stretching time, warping space, and rolling the dice of reality are not just idle curiosities of scientists. Dr. Harold G. White is an advanced propulsion engineer at NASA. He's basically the monster engine to the stars dude. White has been given a green light to begin looking at how we might move through space at what amounts to faster than the speed of light.
That's where you have to engage general relativity and use the idea of being able to expand and contract space in such a way that allows you to cover very large distances in a very short period of time while never locally exceeding the speed of light.
Modern physics and cosmology predict that there might be ways of jumping onto the already expanding universe, folding space over on itself, jumping great distances far faster than even light can travel. And as strange as it sounds, this new approach to space travel, Harold White says, doesn't break any of the rules of our universe.
Well, the speed of light is the cosmological speed limit, right? It's what I like to refer to as the 11th commandment of physics, right? Thou shalt not exceed the speed of light. If one were to try and classically approach and exceed the speed of light, your apparent mass will go to infinity. And so technically, you could never achieve 1C or 1 times the speed of light.
And backing up, when you say the word classically, that's the issue. If I'm driving in a car and I'm going 20 miles an hour and then 50 miles an hour and just ramp that up to 186,000 miles per second, that's where my mass would go to infinity, and that's the rule that you can't violate.
That's correct. It's almost like when you rent a cargo van or something like that. Sometimes they'll come with a built-in governor, right? So when you try and, you know, go past a certain point, the engine just will not let you go any faster.
So the way of going faster than the speed of light involves looking more deeply at the way space itself is constructed. And what you're trying to do is climb aboard another sort of dynamic in the universe that it may not be literally going faster than the speed of light, but it can cover great distances really, really quickly.
Exactly. That's kind of the, I guess, the formal way to say it, right? If you want to go somewhere very quickly, right, so the Voyager 1s are kind of our state-of-the-art interstellar probe, and it's launched back in 77, but it would still take 75,000 years to get to our nearest star, Alpha Centauri. But what if you wanted to cover that distance in weeks or months, fully acknowledging the fact that we have this cosmological speed limit, right? And so that's where you have to engage general relativity and use the idea of being able to expand and contract space in such a way that allows you to do exactly what you said. It allows you to cover very large distances in a very short period of time while never locally exceeding the speed of light.
So the universe is expanding. If you could just find a way of jumping on board that, conveyor belt, you could go places that light wouldn't have to propel you at the speed called C.
That's a good observation, right? We know that inflation is a very real phenomenon. We see evidence for the expansion of space when we see the redshift in stars that are in galaxies very far away from us, right? So that's the evidence that nature can implement this idea, the expansion and contraction of space. And it's kind of a loophole in general relativity, right? The same mathematical formalism that establishes a cosmological speed limit of 186,000 miles a second. It's that same mathematical framework that gives us this loophole that says you can expand and contract space at any speed. And so that allows you to cover that distance between Earth and Alpha Centauri in weeks or months, as measured by clocks on Earth and clocks on board a hypothetical spacecraft.
So to actually test this, and NASA has given you permission to really go down this road here, you've got to measure some things that are pretty hard to measure in sort of quantum mechanics, which as we know, really doesn't like to be measured in the traditional way.
Yeah, you're correct, right? And I think that's a good point to put in some qualifiers. Some of the stuff that we're doing is very much in the realm of science, right? This is something analogous to what you might see in a university. We're trying to work with the physics and the math and try and do a controlled experiment to qualitatively generate a microscopic instance of a wart bubble in a lab. But this is not, we're not trying to work on technology at this point. This is just science trying to make sure we understand the math and physics. And so we're trying to perturb space-time to very, very tiny amounts, like one part in 10 million order of magnitude. So think about if you had an inch of linear space, we're trying to perturb it like on the order of 1/1,000,000th of an inch in terms of the perturbation of length, so to speak.
Boy, I sure am talking to a physicist right now, that's for sure. Man, that is so true. Well, just sketching here on a napkin while you were talking, even getting to 1/1,000th of the speed of light would give us some weekend vacations on the moons of Saturn, right?
Oh, yeah. That's you know, to me, in terms of human exploration, we've been in low Earth orbit for a while, and we've got a lot of stuff out there in the solar system that's just exceedingly interesting, right? And I guess the question would be, one day, as far in the future maybe, right, could you potentially engage this concept to make travel in the solar system a little more routine? And again, I don't know if that's 20 years, 200 years, whatever, but it's just another way to say that we don't just want to look at the romantic vision. There's a lot of other stuff, even here at home, that's interesting that would reduce the requirements and maybe make some of this stuff tractable at some point.
Rings of Saturn, pretty, pretty romantic, I'd say. Harold White, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Harold G. Sonny White is a physicist with the Advanced Propulsion Program at NASA. Thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
Sign of the times in the economy. The good news is that one of the largest retailers in the U.S. is hiring 7,000 people. The bad news, it's Amazon doing the hiring. 5,000 people to pack boxes for shipping in warehouses and 2,000 people to deal with customers who have problems getting their stuff. Customer service. I think of it as the universal experience of the age. The president doesn't think any of this is particularly bad news. He'll be at an Amazon fulfillment center in Chattanooga, Tennessee, to talk about the nation's recovery from the 2008 recession. Amazon has more than quadrupled its labor force since 2008, from more than 20,000 to more than 88,000 workers. And the fact that 2,000 people are being hired for customer service underscores how important customer service is in the 21st century economy. The customer-retailer interaction is, in some ways, the lifeblood of the global interdependent economy. When things are great,
the best service I ever received was one time when I dropped off some dry cleaning. When I picked it up, stapled to my order was an envelope with almost $100 in cash I'd left in my pants pocket. I thought that was pretty extraordinary.
Man, that sticks in his brain. Great customer service. Bruce from Tallahassee told us that story. I know you guys have sharp memories of your own customer service experiences, even if they aren't as sharp as this classic end-of-century scene from the Michael Douglas movie, Falling Down.
Hi, can I help you?
Yes, I'd like a ham and cheese omelet and your wham fries.
I'm sorry, we stopped serving breakfast, but we are on the lunch menu now.
I want breakfast.
Well, you can't have it. We're not serving it.
Is that the manager?
Rick, there's a customer that would like to speak with you.
Yes, sir.
Hi, I'd like some breakfast.
We stopped serving breakfast.
Have you ever heard the expression, the customer is always right?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, here I am, the customer.
Everyone can relate to that scene. Customer service has become critical to the success of businesses online and off. And for some businesses, customer service has actually become the product. With us to explore all of this is Jeffrey Bean, author of The Customer Experience Revolution. Jeffrey, welcome to the show.
Oh, good to be here, John. How are you?
Great. I am fascinated by how important customer service has become. It was once a really fringe thing, but some businesses are designed around customer service. Amazon is one of them.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, John Van Tine and I were so fascinated. You know, that's one of the reasons why we got the idea for the book, and then interviewed and researched a lot of these companies that after we did these interviews and research, we came to call them experience makers, because people have a tendency to really remember the very good and not so good experiences they have.
You know, one of the interesting things about Amazon versus, say, a Macy's or a Saks or a Nordstrom's is that, you know, one of the advantages you have in brick and mortar retail is that even if you have a bad experience or buy a bad product, you retain the memory of being in the store and the smells and the sense of all the stuff around you. Online, you don't really have that opportunity. And so the customer service experience, either in a phone call or some sort of online chat, becomes much more important, and the challenge is to give it the dimensionality of kind of being in a store.
One of the most incredible things that Amazon has done is they have given really given thought to the whole customer experience. And I'm pretty sure that they understand that the customer experience includes all the interactions people have with the messages that they give, as well as the processes and the products and services, as well as the delivery experience. And to your point, John, within the customer experience, there's something called the user experience, and that has to do with the processes, whether it's phone or internet. And Amazon has really set the bar very high for interactions on the internet. And to your point, Amazon not only had to compete with brick and mortar experiences, but other interactions either over the phone or other digital interactions, you know, with other websites. And so they really pay attention to what's called the user experience and try and make it as easy and engaging as possible to find what you're looking for and then place the order for it and feel like you've made an informed decision. And they're exceptional in this way.
You know, one of the things, Jeff, that happened in the evolution of corporations in the 70s and 80s is that people who would deal with the media went from being, you know, low-level corporate officers to, in some cases, being the senior, like number twos to the CEO. The media function was perceived as so important. I'm wondering if customer service is beginning to rise and the head of the user experience in some of these retail operations like Zappos is like a senior officer of the company these days.
As a matter of fact, there's about 5% of the companies around the world that really understand customer experience. And then within that, the customer service component. And absolutely, it's becoming more important, particularly an accelerator is social media or social technology, because you or I, we have a very efficient way of telling many people very quickly what kind of experience did we have at a Zappos or an Amazon. You know, and suddenly that experience can be communicated to so many people and have an impact on that business. Smart businesses are really understanding that it's a very important part. And other businesses who don't understand that, well, sometimes they get pulled into having to deal with the situation in social media because of that quickness that people have in telling many people, hey, here's the experience I've had.
Talking with Jeff Bean, author of The Customer Experience Revolution. Jeff, based on your research, how sticky is the downside? How persistent is a bad experience that someone has either in their own memory or circulating around the media?
Great question. Very sticky. A lot of businesses assign numbers to that. And to your point, if they have a disgruntled customer, they're going to tell many people. And really sharp businesses actually have numbers that one person represents. So one person can represent 1,000 or 10,000. And again, it depends on the business. But it's usually the extremes, the very good experiences and the very bad experiences that are extremely significant to the impact.
Before we go, if I was a college student and I applied for one of these customer service jobs at Amazon, are they good jobs?
I believe they are good jobs because of the learning experience and the compensation from a competitive standpoint, and certainly it's going to help them lead to better things. It's the learning about working for an experience maker company that's going to give students the advantage if their interest lies in this in the future. Absolutely.
Jeff Bean, the author of The Customer Experience Revolution. Thanks so much, Jeff.
Oh, it was a pleasure to be here, John. Thank you.
And your call was very important to us. We're hearing from you, your best and worst customer service experiences.
This is Seth from Hoboken, and one time I ordered some speakers off of Sweetwater, and when I got the speakers, they also sent me candy. They sent me candy. There's no better customer service than candy.
Here's a great story from Amanda in Salt Lake City. When I worked at Yellowstone, I was constantly berated for bad weather. I also had tourists ask things like, when do they let the animals out? We heard this from one of you in Seattle. The best was when I had a new mattress box spring set delivered from Macy's. It was delivered by two polite young men. After they took the old set out, they thoroughly vacuumed the room before bringing the new set in. They also partially made the bed. Did I tip them? Yes. Thanks for that story. We always want to hear from you. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway, and you can catch up on this conversation or listen back to anything on the show at thetakeaway.org. Your call is so important to us. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of The New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.